Turn, if you will, please, to the book of Ruth, chapter 1. Ruth chapter 1, beginning in verse 14. And they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, and Ruth clung to her. Then she said, "Behold, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or turn back from following you, for where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I shall die, and there I will be buried. Thus may the Lord do to me, and worse, if anything but death parts you and me." When she saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. So they both went until they came to Bethlehem. Bow with me, a word of prayer. Father, guide us, we pray, this morning in our time together. It is to your word we come. It is your will we seek. It is your Spirit who is our teacher. So guide us in every thought that we think and every consideration that we do. We pray that you will be glorified. Guide us into the truth you seek for us to see, and then guide us into a changed life that you seek to see in us. Thank you again. We praise you in Christ's name. Amen. We come to the second in our discussion or series on Ruth. And we're going to lay some background again, and I remind you again of this biblical principle, and we're back to where principles are the issue. We so often dwell on the extrapolation that we get from that, but the principles are the issue, and we need to stay there. And the principle in this case is really the fact that, as far as the Bible is concerned, the primary purpose of the Bible is to tell us about God, not primarily about man or men. That is huge. And especially as we come to this book. We've looked at the book of Joshua together, and we see that the book of Joshua is not the story of Joshua, but the story of God. And Joshua continually, time after time, reminds us that God is the one who is the actor in there, and he is merely the one who works with him. Same is true in the Pentateuch. The same is true in the rest of the Bible. So today, as we come and we look at an individual, our primary purpose, though, is to see how God works through each child of his for his glory. We're not focusing on the person, but on the God who gives us this account. As again, I remind you, a background to this is from the book of Romans that affects the life of that church and our life as well. And then I want to remind you of especially this statement. Theology affects life. I'm going to come back to it later, but just to tell you, if what you believe does not work itself out in your life, there's a major, major, major problem. In fact, for many of us, we don't need a theology shift. We need an attitude shift. And we will see that as we walk through this book today. And then there is, in all of the theological truths of Romans, an amazing biblical principle that I think that that comes out to us, and especially we see it when we come to Romans chapter 6. No doubt the theological truth, God sovereignly guides and directs our lives. We see it every step of the way, and especially in Romans 9 through 11. God graciously and mercifully and lovingly guides and directs each of our lives. We see that in Romans 5, we see it in chapter 12. I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God. So we understand it's God's mercy that does this for us. But the issue when we come to chapter 6 is that we see our condition, chapters 1 to 3. We see what God has done for us, chapter 3 to 5. Now we come to chapter 6 and says, now what must you do to respond to God? So the issue is, in this passage, as we come to Romans 6, is that, but it's the truth of the whole book. Let me take you to the way we've outlined the book. As you deal, the word therefore in chapter 12, verse 1, is the hinge upon which the whole book rests. He says, I beseech you, therefore, by the mercies of God, that's God's provision, that you present your bodies, that's our responsibility. Now, if you just walk through the book with me. In our sinfulness, God provided in His sovereignty salvation and sanctification. Now, what must I do in response to God? I must give Him service, sacrificial love, submission to authority, and self-denial. The point of all of this is that the whole message of the book is precisely this. How do we respond to the provision God has made in our life? That's what Romans 12:1 is introducing, our response to God's provision. So in that regard, we looked at the book of Ruth and we see there are two foci. If it makes you feel better, focuses, that's all right with me. On the one side, there's the provision of God. On the other side, there's the response of man. We are going to continue our study of Ruth today, and we focused last week on the provision of God. And today we want to focus on the response of man, in this case, a woman, if you will. But first of all, let me remind you about the background of the book. Ruth has been called the most beautiful short story ever written. And that's a valid point. The beautiful part of it is that through the conversations between the major people, both Ruth, Naomi, and Boaz, and actually it's in reverse order, we see the story emerging. A beautiful, beautiful story. It is also one of the, called one of the most delightful literary compositions of the ancient world. And it is true, you see the dialogue, the characterizations, the repetition. And I'm going to show you some of that today, just in words. The plot is carried out in such a beautiful way by the author, and he does it through the way he handles all of this. I love this statement by Jensen. This is the only instance in the Bible in which a whole book is devoted to the domestic history of a woman, which is fascinating. By the way, it is interesting because Ruth is in such a beautiful position in our Bibles, because its setting is in the time of Judges, and after the horrible story of Judges, there's a great story in Judges, but there's so many, you know, ups and downs, that you finally come to Ruth and it gives you such a beautiful, beautiful picture of just what the positive side during that period of time. What's interesting in the Hebrew text that Pastor Steve has with him is that Ruth is put after the book of Proverbs. And why that is significant is because Proverbs 31 is the statement about the godly woman and then comes right into the book of Ruth. And very fascinating, the order that was taken in that case. But as you look at some basic observations, important to notice the majority of the book is centered around dialogue, people talking. The rest of the book, 48%, is a narrator. And maybe Samuel in this case, we're not sure who it is. Whoever it is putting together the story in such a beautiful way. But what is significant is that almost all the references to God, all but two, are in the dialogue, the 52%, not in the narrator's comments. In other words, the narrator doesn't say a lot about God. What he does say about God is significant. Only two references, this one here, and basically this is an indirect reference where she heard, Naomi, that the Lord had visited his people. But the only statement, direct statement the narrator makes in this book is such a dynamic statement. And that is the interesting part of this, the Lord enabled her to conceive. That is the narrator's comment. And that is an amazing, amazing comment. The fact that everything is orchestrated by a sovereign God. So, although the narrator doesn't do a lot to tell us about God, in a sense he does, because the actions and participation of God is seen all the way through the book. And I like the way someone put it, you see the hidden hand of God. By the way, I just therefore remind you, stop and look back in your life at the hidden hand of God. I have been responding myself to the message of last week in so many different ways. Now I'll come to that in a moment. But it's interesting because why is it called the Book of Ruth? And one wonders at that, because it's remarkable because this is the only book named after a non-Israelite in the Old Testament. And with regard to that, she's not even the main character of the book. Naomi is. So for some reason, and the author's purpose is to bring us to the genealogy and bring us to the fact that Ruth was in the line of David, and he wants to point to David, not to point to Ruth, and yet you can't miss her involvement here. 55 of the 85 verses are involved with dialogue. The three main characters speak, but Ruth's section is shorter than anybody else's. So, as you look at this, there's no doubt that there's some fascination by the author and the reader with regard to this, and Ruth is, again, the name of the book. One wonders why not call the book of Naomi. It begins with Naomi's central figure, it ends with Naomi as a central figure. Everything in it, it starts with the emptiness of Naomi, no husband, no sons, and it ends with the fullness of Naomi, now a grandson, and people saying to her, this daughter-in-law is more precious to you than if you had seven sons. One might wonder why it's not called the Book of Boaz, because he is the main talker in this book, and without him, there is no story. Yet again, although Ruth's words are less than anybody else's, it is her words that we remember. Whither thou goest, I will go. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God. I like this version. It's the old one, of course. And it was sung at our wedding, actually, 50 years ago. By the way, just as an interesting thing. 50 years ago, July the 5th was on a Friday, just as this year. I'd waited a year to get married because my folks were in Africa, and they didn't, in those days, you didn't come home for things like this. My father wasn't at either of his parents' funerals. It just wasn't a thing you did. So we waited an extra year to get married so that my parents could be here and my father could do the service. My father did the service on Friday night, and then on Sunday, he filled the pulpit for me. Rather interesting for me, I get to fill the pulpit for my son exactly 50 years later on the same July the 7th, which is rather intriguing and fun for me. But he filled the pulpit for me that Sunday, he did. The interesting part as you look at this, you really, in a sense, you wonder why it's not called the Book of Obed, because the primary purpose of this whole book is to lead us to the genealogy in chapter 4. These are the generations of Perez. To Perez was born Hezron. To Hezron, Ram. And to Ram, Amminadab. And to Amminadab, Nashon. To Nashon, Salmon. To Salmon was born, by the way, Salmon is the husband of Rahab the harlot. And to Salmon was born Boaz. So you see, actually, then Ruth's mother-in-law was she had two mother-in-laws, okay, but the other one was Rahab, Naomi and Rahab both. And to Obed was born Jesse, and to Jesse David. So the whole point of the book is this. In fact, if this weren't in the book, you wouldn't have the book of Ruth in the Old Testament. It's pretty simple. And yet, it's undeniably there because many books are challenged, but not this one. But this is why it's there. But the interesting part, Obed is the point, Naomi is the central figure, Boaz is key to it all, and yet you see it's called Ruth, the only non-Israelite name given in the Old Testament to a book. Last week, again, we saw there's a provision of God. This week, we want to look at the response of man. We focused last week on God's sovereignty, and well, we should, but now we want to focus on how we respond to His providence in our life and provision. Some important considerations. Again, I remind you, the narrator's portion of the book, 48%, only two references to God, and yet it is God-centered. Last week, we focused on God's sovereignty and His many manifestations. One author is given a very important reminder as he writes this, and it's a point I want to dwell on for a moment. The story form should not blind the reader to the book's theological values, chief of which the emphasis on the providence of God. In other words, you read the story of Ruth, but don't get caught up with Elimelech or Naomi or Mahlon or Chilion or Orpah or Ruth or Boaz. No, you need to be caught up with God and His sovereignty. And the danger is so often we look at the story and dwell on the story instead of dwelling on the point of the story. Although there are so few references by the narrator to God, there is no doubt, you see, there is the hidden hand of God throughout this whole book. In light of this, it's interesting because a few weeks ago we looked at Matthew 1. And I just quickly go back here. God, in Matthew 1, three messages. God is and always will be sovereign. Whether it's Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah, or Perez. And Perez leads right into this book because he is the key figure here in the genealogy. God is and always will be sovereign. And God is and always will be faithful. He made a promise to David. He made a promise to Abraham. He kept them both. And he will always keep his promise. I'm reading through Jeremiah on my personal reading and God's statement over and over again. You see, if in fact the sun and the moon and all stops functioning, then he says, my word concerning Israel will as well. But in other words, since it's not going to stop, neither will my words to Israel. God is faithful to his promise. But now look at this. You look at these and I'll tell you, and I've got to be careful here because I shy so far away from being in any way irreverent. I wouldn't, you see, why are these the only four women mentioned? Why? Why not Sarah? Why not Rachel? Why not, I mean, somebody else? Why these? If I am choosing, of the wives of David, there are only three that stand out. There's the daughter of Saul he married, and that was a mess. And then there was the Abigail that he married. And then there's Bathsheba. Now there were others, but those are three that are mentioned specifically and were told about. If I'm choosing, I'm choosing Abigail. I mean, I like the lady. I like what she has to offer. Why in the world? But see, listen to me carefully. We wouldn't choose these people, and so we dare not get carried away with the you know, if you will, the sideline here. The primary issue is God, not these people. You see, it is God's sovereignty, it is God's faithfulness, God's graciousness. And you see, we dare not get caught up with the storyline and miss the message. And it's easy to do. I mean, why in the world, Rahab? See, I don't see, this is the great part. I don't understand why God does what he does. I don't even understand how he makes it happen. I just know what he does, right? And this is what he does. So as we come to the book of Ruth, let's not lose sight of that as well. Now, I need to set another background with regard to this, a biblical principle. See, in Hebrews 11, and I'm going to just quickly give you, we've been here before, but I want to just walk with you in here. Hebrews 11, God is calling for faith. He's calling for a vibrant faith. Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. For by it men of old gained approval and obtained a testimony. By faith Enoch obtained a witness that before his being taken up, he was pleasing to God. And without faith it is impossible to please God. So we see that God demands a vibrant faith and expects a vibrant faith from us, okay? Point number two. God expects a faith that does something. By faith, Abel offered to God a better sacrifice than Cain. By faith, Noah prepared an ark. By faith, Abraham obeyed and went out not knowing where he was going. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up his son. By faith, Moses left Egypt not fearing the wrath of the king. See, the interesting part of this, faith does something. It's the whole point of James. Don't talk about faith. Live it. In other words, if it's going to be a vibrant faith, it must be something you do. But now, I want to draw a point here that's so crucial. That faith is unique. All the acts of faith you and I do are unique to us. Nobody else is called to do the same thing we are. I tire of people who compare themselves with other people. They want to be like somebody else. I just keep going back. There were two ladies and they were both women who sought so much to please God. And they were both reaching out to the lost continuously. And one of them one day says to me, I wish I was like this other lady. And I said, why in the world do you want to be like somebody else? You have such a vibrant testimony. God so vibrant, use your life. Why do you want to be like somebody else? We do this cookie cutter stuff and we want to try to be exactly like somebody else's. It's interesting, years ago, somebody was caught. They got the tape of somebody sharing their personal testimony, and it was John MacArthur's testimony. And I think Dr. Roscoe got word of somebody using his testimony at some time. Why in the world do you want somebody else's testimony? Yours is great. No, just stop it, because I want you to notice it's so important to what we do as a background to this. Noah was called to build an ark. Abraham wasn't. Samson surely wasn't. Are you with me? Abraham is called to offer up Isaac. Don't you dare try offering up your son. It isn't the thing to do, but God called him to do it. It was unique to him. Rahab was called to hide the spies, and this is treasonous. It just is. I mean, Benedict Arnold, all he's known for, not his great endeavors in behalf of our country, but the fact he was a traitor. She was, and God honored it. Samson was called to topple a building. Everybody is called to do it. Peter, throw your net on the other side. See, everybody, the challenge is different than the other person's. It's not the same. God didn't make us to be exactly the same. Although Joshua follows Moses so specifically and the principles he lives by, he does not do it in the way he lives. When Moses went out, he lifted a staff as a shepherd. Whenever Joshua went out, he lifted a spear as a soldier. They were uniquely different. They were called to different tasks. They were called to do something different. You are not called to do what I'm called to do, and I'm not called to do what you're called to do. Our response is uniquely our own. Our circumstances are uniquely our own. See, Gideon, trim down your troops. That's unique. It's different. Joshua, march around Jericho. Abigail, go talk to David. Esther, go to the presence of a king. None of these called to do what the other was called to do. And God doesn't call you to do what he calls anybody else to do. He calls you uniquely to respond to him. So God's measure of what we're doing is not some cookie cutter model. We will never be faced with the precise situation Ruth faced, or anyone else faces for that matter. But we can learn from this account what kind of response pleases God. That's the issue. Now, with regard to this, before looking at Ruth, I need to just for a while call your attention to Naomi and her response. Notice, first of all, she recognized God's hand in the circumstances. She says, the hand of the Lord is against me. She says, the Almighty has dealt very bitterly, with me. Now listen, she understood God's hand was in it, but her response to the sovereignty of God was not what it ought to be. Her response was, don't call me pleasant, call me bitter. You see, let me say something to you. That's what I said earlier. Many of us don't need a theology fix. We need an attitude fix. You and I may know with Naomi that God is a sovereign God and that he's behind all the circumstances of our life. But many of us are just like this woman. We become bitter at what God brings into our life, and it is not right. We so often respond the same way. Just as an aside for you for a while, in James 1, just watch this. Okay, I'll let it do it on its own. Watch this. So whenever, unexpectedly, we fall into the midst of and are completely surrounded by, multicolored, variegated external trials, we are to count it nothing but joy at that precise moment in time. See, it's not good enough at the end of the book to say, oh my goodness, look at what God did through all those years and how I didn't even see it. We need to stop at the moment the trial begins and count it nothing but joy, because we realize that God's hand is in the situation. Now, with that as a background, I take you to Ruth. Ruth chapter 1. The interesting part is her response. God introduces the circumstances into her life. And by the way, she's not some well-known theologian in this book. In fact, the matter is none of the statements about God come from her. Her commitment to God comes from her, but none of this, because she is a Moabitess. She is not into all the theology that Boaz knows and Naomi knows. But the interesting part is her response. Okay, let's go. Chapter 1, verse 1. It came about in those days when the judges governed that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the land of Moab with his wife and his two sons. And the name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion, Ephrathites of Bethlehem in Judah. Now they entered the land of Moab and remained there. Then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. And they took for themselves Moabite women as wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth. And they lived there about 10 years. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and the woman was bereft of her two children and her husband. That's the circumstance. The interesting part of this, look at that 1:6. Then she arose with her daughters-in-law that she might return from the land of Moab, for she had heard the land of Moab that the Lord had visited his people in giving them food. So they departed from the place where she was and her two daughters-in-law with her, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. Okay, this is the setting. The interesting part, 1:13. And what happens in 1:13, this is Naomi speaking. It's, well, let me go back to 1:12. If I said, I have hope, if I should even have a husband tonight and also bear sons, would you therefore wait until they were grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? Now, understand the issue, the way God had set it up in the Levitical system, was that if you, as an older brother, marry a wife and you die and have no children, your brother is not obligated to marry the wife, but he is obligated to go into the wife and have a child that becomes your child. You're dead and your memory still continues on. We'll see that in Boaz's response later. And so she says, okay, now, if I were to even have a husband, I don't even have one. If I had a husband, I bore children. Are you willing to wait that long for a child to grow up so that you would marry that child? She says, I don't think so. So she says to her, it's better that you go back into the land where you came from. So here we have it. In verse 14, they lift up their voices and wept. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. Then she said, behold, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. But Ruth said, do not urge me to leave you or turn back from following you. For where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Interesting, because he says, and she says, where you die, I will die, and there I shall be buried. Thus may the Lord do to me and more, if anything but death parts you and me. And we'll come back to that in a moment. But when she saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more to her. She realizes it's a lost cause. Now Boaz is responding. Chapter 2, verse 11. And it's interesting because Boaz has come out to the field and he sees this woman. And he's impressed by this woman. He says, who is she? That's an interesting question. Who is she? And they say that this is the Ruth the Moabitess who's come out of the land with Naomi. And so he goes to talk to her. Now he had not seen Ruth before, but he knew all about her. So in chapter 2, verse 11, he says this. Boaz answered and said to her, all that you have done for your mother-in-law after the death of your husband has been fully reported to me. And how you left your father and your mother in the land of your birth and came to a people you did not previously know. See, he has analyzed the selfless sacrifice of this woman. She had a living father and a living mother, according to Boaz. She had a land that she was used to, a country she was used to, people she was used to, and she left everything that meant anything to her. And she had nothing. I mean, she didn't have a husband, she didn't have children to tie her to Naomi, and all she has is a depressed mother-in-law that she's going to be working with for the next few years. until finally, by God's grace through Ruth, the depression is taken away. But fascinating in here, because the sacrifice cannot be missed. She left everything that meant anything to her to go somewhere, to a people she did not know, a land she did not know, and certainly a set of customs she had no acquaintance with. When, in fact, in chapter 3, she's told to do what she does to initiate or respond to Boaz's initiation of a relationship to her, when she's told to do that, this is all out of the orbit of what she's used to. So it's interesting, because you watch at the beginning the selfless sacrifice of this woman as she responded to circumstances that God brought into her life. The second thing that you see and you can't miss is not only selfless sacrifice, but selfless surrender. Return, my daughters, go back. Ruth says, I'm not going back. Don't tell me to leave. For where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. And it's interesting, because she makes this commitment. Now, fascinating in all of this, Boaz and Naomi make the major statements about God in this book. Ruth isn't the place to do it. She isn't learned in the ways of the God of Israel. But watch this. Ruth said, do not urge me, because I will go where you go, and your God will be my God. And it's interesting, because not God's. And you see, if you look at the previous verses in this section, you'll find where it says that Naomi tells her that your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods, plural. The one thing she understands, it's not a plurality of gods here. It's only one God. But notice something else. She says, may the Lord, and she uses the term Yahweh. If you see it, it is in your Bible, it's capital L, small capital O-R-D. Different than the small O-R-D that you'll find. That's a different name for God. But capital O-R-D, that is the God of Israel. Well, go with me. Chapter 2, verse 12. And we'll come to this, but notice, may the Lord reward your work, and your wages be full from the Lord. This is Boaz talking. The God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to seek refuge. Interesting, because for Naomi, she talks about the gods of the Moabites, but when it comes to Boaz, he says, you know what, I realize what you've done. You have placed yourself under the wings of the Lord, the God of Israel, Yahweh, the God of Israel. We sang that song this morning, and I asked for that, under his wings, because this is where she says, I'm willing to put myself under his wings. My memory of that song, you can't appreciate it, but it's all right. When we lived in Africa and the storms were pretty bad at night, and then there were wild dogs that would chase around outside the house, howling, if you will, and in the rain like that coming down the roof, I remember as a young child, my father would come into the room, into our bedroom, and he would sing under his wings, I'm safely abiding. And for the rest of my life, I will never forget the peace that it brought to us, and it talks about the tempest and stuff in the song, the peace that it brought because we were, again, under his wings. But this is her statement. She left the way that she knew. She came to a God that she didn't fully understand. But she says to him, and it's interesting in this context like this, and by the way, it's interesting. He says, may the Lord reward your work and your wages before. Do you realize, go through the book of Ruth and just read it. It's such a beautiful story and so short. You know, every prayer in this book is a prayer of blessing, and every one of those prayers are answered. Every one of them. We'll see some more as we walk through today. Every prayer in this book is a prayer of blessing, and every one of those prayers is answered by God in this account. So, the point he's making, he says, I see what you've done, for example, with regard to your mother-in-law, but what you've done with regard to God, you have left the gods of the Moabites, and you've come here to put yourself under the wings of Yahweh, the God of Israel. There's a major selfless surrender on her part as she surrenders herself to a God that she did not fully understand, to a theology she did not fully understand, but this commitment she understood, and she never went back on her commitment. Interesting, then I take you to selfless service. It's interesting, the selflessness of this woman. Watch what happens. Chapter 2, verse 1. And in the context, it says in 2:1 that Ruth, Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, a man of great wealth of the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, "Please let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after one in whose sight I may find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." So she departed, went, and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened by the field of Boaz. Now, I want you some key thoughts in here which are interesting here. First of all, 2:7a, she came and she remained from the morning until night. I want to talk about that in a moment here, but it's interesting, 2:7a. So it says, "Please let me gather," and she said they could, and then she came and she remained there from the morning until now. This is not, I'll tell you, let me just wait. Literally, she hasn't left to go home. She just hangs around. And in fact, all she's done, she once in a while, she'll sit down in the shade over there, but she has worked hard. Now, one scholar suggests that the statement, "she has remained from morning until now," defies explanation. He says, any guess at what it is? It's purely a guess, okay? But let me give you some renderings of it. Listen to some attempts. The Septuagint says she has not rested in the field. This is a woman who just keeps on working. Let me try another one. Another says the field has been her residence. In other words, because somehow in here there's a mention of home, but it doesn't make sense from the Hebrew strictly, and so people are trying to figure out exactly what it is. But the point of it is she's not gone home. She came here and she stayed here. Another says the house has meant little to her. Another says she has stopped only for a moment. Now the whole point, if you want to get any one of these renderings, trying to figure out what this passage is saying, she's worked very hard and she's worked very long and she doesn't quit. Only once in a while will she go sit down in the shade. Okay, now watch this. Watch with me. So verse 17 of chapter 2. That's what she did. So she gleaned in the field until evening. See, she's all day. She hasn't left. And she beat out what had been gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. Now, there's a big debate of how much an ephah is and all this kind of stuff, but just bear with me here. Because one person has said that that's normally 10 times what a man would normally do in a day. Now that's just one rendering. The point, just you'll get the point in the end. Whatever it was, some of it was hard work and some of it was Boaz, because remember Boaz told those people, you know, make sure that you leave some for her out there in the field. So he was helping out, but there's no doubt she was working hard. And that's the point of the passage as well. Both of them are tied together. So this is a statement by the man who says that you can't figure this out exactly. He says, by either standard, to thresh an ephah of grain for one day's labor is an extraordinary feat, and not to mention Ruth having to carry this home. So it's amazing, because she has nothing that ties her there aside from a commitment. By the way, it just go back. You know, people, when it comes to marriage, they break it off. Interesting reaction, by the way. I was in Costco. Some lady says, "What are you doing over the 4th? And I said, "Well, it's February 4th, and then 5th is our anniversary, 50th. And she says, "You know, my parents just are about to celebrate 50, so I contacted my parents and said, "What should we do to help you celebrate?" And they said, "You better not do anything. We're getting a divorce." I said, "After 50 years? And they said, "Well, I think they were waiting for our youngest brother to get out of the home, and he's 34. And so, then I walk in to get a light fixed in the back of my car the other day, and the guy who fixed it, they really are pretty good. They just charge the price of the bulb, that's it. So he says, "Go tell the lady in there that just $297 for a bulb." So I walk in there, and I said, "They told me $297 for a bulb. I'm just doing what I'm told." She says, "You must be married," she says, to take somebody's word for it and do what they tell you. And I said, "Yeah," I says, "for 50 years. And now I told her the story about that lady who about 50 years ago broke up. She said, well, she says, I did after 30. This, the interesting part of all of this business, you watch this and you think, you know, they say, you know, there's not love anymore. You know, the issue is commitment. You say before God and before the people that this is what I do till death do our part, death to us part. You know what holds a marriage together? The fact that you gave your word before God and before the people, and you're going to maintain that no matter, because there is no marriage that doesn't have its rough spots. I am sharing. I had a retreat when I first came back from Africa in 1973, and I asked a fellow who'd been a member of the church before to go up and do this retreat. And we're driving up, and I said, you know the greatest thing that happened in Mission Field? We saw an amazing number of people saved and things we did. We saw just amazing stuff, but I said, the greatest thing that happened in the Mission Field was our marriage and what God did to bring us together. We were on the, we were out of the end of nowhere. There was no radio, there was no TV, there was electric lights for 2 hours at night and that's it. We were in the very end and we could look out for miles and see nothing. And you know what? All we had was each other. And we had no choice but to learn to talk to each other. And I had been so busy this side of the ocean before I went out there, is that we served together so continuously, but we never had this time where we're just away in the end of nowhere. We had no car. We couldn't afford a car. We couldn't even afford to rent the car that the school had to take a trip. The only way we got to make trips was when they needed something done and they paid for the trip and we'd do it for them. We had no choice but to become very acquainted with each other. And we learned to talk to each other as we'd never learned to talk to each other before. You know, marriage takes work. It doesn't just come. And the issue is you make a commitment and no matter what happens, you're going to fulfill that commitment. A commitment before God and a commitment before others, but a commitment you make to each other, and you're not going to let it end. So anyhow, just coming back to this, it's interesting because this is a commitment she makes and she's not going to fall back on that commitment. But I want to take you to something else, 2:18. Interesting what happens in 2:18. She took it up, this ephah of barley, however much it was. She went into the city and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. Now notice, here's the statement, she also, see the word also? She also took, okay, she also took it out and gave to Naomi what she had left after she was satisfied. Now I think to myself, in fact, one commentary says that this, she took what grain she needed and gave Naomi the rest. I don't think, that may be. I don't think so though. Let me tell you why. Look back with me at 2:14. In 2:14, it says, so she sat beside the reapers and he, Boaz, served her roasted grain and she ate and was satisfied and she had some left. It's the same statement how it comes right after this, see. I think what she did was she not only brought all of that grain into her, when she's having lunch, she took what she needed to be satisfied and she took the rest and took it home to her mother-in-law that night. No, the whole point of this thing is the way that she looks out for a woman to whom she has no connection other than the fact she was married to her son, but there are no sons, there are no children, there is nothing, and she leaves to come here selflessly giving herself to serve and to serve as hard as she did. This is Ruth. Let me take you further. Selfless submission. 3:1. Now, Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, my daughter, shall I not seek security for you? I'm going to come back to that it may be well with you. You know, the emphasis in this passage is on a kinsman redeemer. And it comes out because it's actually the term is used in this book. It's from a Hebrew word, goel or gaal, two different forms of it, which has the idea of redeeming or buying back. Now, it's interesting because it is found in Leviticus 25, Deuteronomy 25, and is found 23 times in this book. No book discusses this as much as this book does. In fact, this is the book that so pictures what it's all about. In this, it includes providing a child for a deceased brother's childless widow. It doesn't mean you marry her. In this case, Boaz married Ruth. It doesn't necessarily mean you marry her, but you raise up a child for in the memory of her dead husband. But also include buying family land that have been sold. You can look at this, Leviticus 25. It was important because it wasn't like we buy property today. By the way, we have this property because a friend of ours, his dad, left him the farmland that he had here, and so he sold the farmland for subdivision, and that's what this is part of. And therefore, he gave us this property, these two pieces of property, the one next door. But see, in that day, it was a big issue to keep what was the family property. You remember when Ahab wanted Naboth's vineyard? One of the reasons Naboth's not giving this up, this has been the family. It's a family heritage. You don't sell it, give it away. And if you do happen to sell it because you're in hard times, you may have a redeemer who comes in to buy it back so it can be back in the family again. It includes, in this case, they had families that were sold into slavery, family members, and so you would buy them back. It also included looking after a needy or helpless family member. It was very broad in its involvement. So, in other words, you looked out for family members, and I think probably a worthwhile thing for us to keep in mind. But there's an unfortunate example of this. Okay, here is the what we've read before from chapter 4. To Perez was born Hezron, and Perez is the issue we want to deal with here. He's the key one here. And they said, may you be like Perez, and may you be like Tamar, okay? Watch this. Interesting part of this, Judah had three sons. He had a son Ur, he had a son Onan, he had a son Shelah. Now Ur marries a woman by the name of Tamar. Now, when Ur dies, then Onan is supposed to go in and make sure that Tamar has a child to carry on the heritage of the oldest brother Ur. Onan doesn't want to do it, so God killed him because of it. So now, Judah is responsible to give Shelah to Tamar, but he doesn't do it. And when Shelah becomes of age and he doesn't send him into Tamar to raise up a child for his brother Ur, she decides, I'm going to get involved in this process. So she goes and dresses like a harlot, which tells you something she knew about her father-in-law. It's a shameful thing, but she knew. So she dresses like a harlot. She waits by the side of the road. He comes. She has a relationship with her, and he has no clue who she is. She's not going to let him see. He gives her the staff, the signet ring, and then later he finds out she's pregnant. He calls her in to say to her, you need to die because you shouldn't have done this. And she says, it's by the person who owns this that I became pregnant. And he realizes he is the father of twins, actually, through his daughter-in-law. That is an unfortunate story. But that's how Perez was born. Perez's brother, which means brightness, zero. He puts out his hand first, the hand comes back, so they put a ribbon around that to note which one came first, he pulls it back in, Perez comes out, therefore he breached, therefore they called him breach all the rest of his life, that's what Perez means, so old breach is the one here who's the father of this line, okay? What's interesting, that is an unfortunate account, but look at the fortunate account. To Salmon was born Boaz, and to Boaz Obed, to Obed was born Jesse, to Jesse David. Look at chapter 4, verse 10. Great statement. So now what happens? Moreover, I have acquired Ruth the Moabite. What happened was, he says to Ruth, he says, there's somebody ahead of me in line, okay? And I need to solve this legally and biblically, if you will. So he goes the next day and he has this meeting with the elders. And the fellow who's first in line comes by and he says, you know what? Somebody has to buy Elimelech's land. He says, well, I want to do that. And he says, well, you have to take Ruth with it. And he says, I'm not going there. So therefore, he broke that covenant. And he indicated there before them. And so now Boaz has the right to marry her. Now listen to Boaz. I have acquired Ruth the Moabitess, the widow of Mahlon, to be my wife in order to raise up, notice, the name of the deceased on his inheritance. So the name of the deceased Mahlon may not be cut off from his brothers or from the court of his birthplace, you are witnesses today. I understand what I'm doing. I'm not raising up this son for me. I'm raising up the son for my, if you will, what would it be? This boy, whatever. I'll call him a brother-in-law, for I don't know what else to call him. But in this case, Machlon, right? See, he understood the point. I am willing to do this. I love you, but I'm willing to do this in order to raise up a seed for this man. I want to come back to that later. The pursuit of this. Chapter 3, verse 1. Naomi, her mother-in-law, said, "My daughter, shall I not seek?" And if you look in your margin, it says, "Rest for you, that it may be well with you." Go back with me to chapter 1, verse 9, a related word. Naomi, in this case, is talking to them and says, "May the Lord," again, Yahweh, "grant that you may find rest," the same related word, "each in the house of her own husband." You know, it's interesting here, this is a related issue. The word, again, manoah here in this place of rest, derives from the same root as manuha in 1:9, and speaks of the security and tranquility the woman in Israel longed for and expected to find the home of a loving husband. She says, "Why don't you two go home and find your own husband and find your own rest in that relationship?" And Ruth says, "I'm not going home, I'm going with you." She says, "Okay, in chapter 3, then I see it as my responsibility to find someone who will therefore come in and give you that kind of rest and that kind of security in a marriage." So this is where she begins from. And she tells her, and let me go back there, she tells her what to do, and it's interesting, I'm just going to make this account, I'm not going to go through the story. She tells her, "Here's what I want you to do." Then listen to it, it's verse 3. "Wash yourself therefore and anoint yourself and put on your best clothes." You know what? She's been a woman in mourning. She says it's now time to move from mourning to marriage. "I want you to go and get cleaned up, and I want you to dress in the nicest clothes you have, and I want you going down there where Boaz is doing the threshing." So she sends her down there. And she says, "I want you to go down to the threshing floor, and do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. And it shall be when he lies down that you shall notice the place where he lies. You should go to uncover his feet and lie down, and then he will tell you what you shall do." See, it's interesting. He shall tell you what to do. And she said to her, "All that you say, I will do." Nobody understands fully what this is all about. I don't think. I mean, there are people, and I don't want to get into it. They talk about the uncovering has sexual implications, stuff like that. You know why I don't believe any of that stuff? I just, for a lot of reasons. It's interesting that she does this. And it's fascinating because when she comes down to see Boaz, and he sees who she is, okay, in this point, okay. He is, it's interesting because he talks about, notice, verse 11 of chapter 3. "And now my daughter," this is Boaz talking, "do not fear. I will do for you whatever you ask. For all my people in the city know that you are a woman of excellence." Listen, this isn't a woman who tarnished what her reputation by going down there that night, nor did he tarnish his reputation in return with her. Whatever it is, and they drop all this stuff because nobody knows exactly. They have no clue. But they say, "Well, some of this word has sexual implications and so forth." You know what? It wasn't about that. I don't know what Naomi told her to do. I just know that Ruth did what she was told to do, and she went down there. By the way, it's interesting. The one thing that was fascinating, she says, "All you say I will do," because he says, "You just say whatever you do, whatever you tell me, I'll do." But when she went down there, she says, "I want you to be my nearer of kinsmen and redeem me." She says that to him. That was her added part to this. But you know the beautiful part of all of this? It wasn't a filthy thing. It wasn't a demeaning thing. It wasn't a thing that a prostitute would do, as some suggest. It wasn't that. This story is not that kind of a story. And by the way, the other side to that is, not only the statement of Boaz to her and so forth and even the thing, but the Bible, when there is an evil thing, it paints it evil. It doesn't paint this as anything being evil. So, do I understand what it is? Nobody truly understands exactly how this fit in. But Ruth did exactly what Naomi told her to do. Now she comes to the field. Now she comes and she reveals herself to Boaz.
When he'd eaten and drunk, his heart was merry. He went and lay down, verse 7. Happened in the middle of the night that the man was startled and bent forward, and behold, a woman was lying at his feet, and he said, "Who are you?" She says, "I am Ruth, your maid." So spread your cover over your maid, for you are a chosen relative. I can take you to a verse where God says, "I did this to Israel." It's a way of indicating a marriage relationship. By the way, it's fascinating. What happens is Boaz has made his play for Ruth. He's opened up and let Ruth know how much he cares by saying, "Stay at my field, don't go anywhere else." Now he's waiting for her to make a response back, and Naomi tells her what to do, and she goes and makes the response, and she says to Boaz, "I'm ready." And it's interesting, by the way, in the statement about this, look at verse 10. He said, "May you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter. You've shown your last kindness to be better than the first." In other words, what you did to your mother-in-law was amazing. What you're doing for me is even more amazing. Why? Because by not going to after young men, whether poor or rich, you come to an older man like this and you're willing to be my husband. It's an amazing thing, he says. But he says, "I'll tell you what it is. I'll do what it is you want me to do." But he says, "There's somebody who stands between me and you, and I need to go settle that." See, he was going to do it righteously. He was going to do it biblically. But by the way, he was going to do it in a hurry. The next day, I mean, you like this guy because he gets it done. But he does it right. He goes to the city gate, he goes in front of the elders, but you see, she had to submit to what he told her. It wasn't hers to do. She did what Naomi told her, she did what Boaz told her. But may I suggest to you, it's farther than that, it's a submission to God. See, when Boaz says to her, "You have placed yourself under God's wings. You have sought His protection, His guidance." And we looked at it last week. God's sovereignty is evidence in the overall design of our lives. We see this in the whole book of Ruth. God's sovereignty is evident in the circumstances of our lives. When there's famine in the land, that's of God, that's not of man. Well, it's man's sin that causes God to do it. The sovereignty is evident in the choices of our lives. Sovereignty of God is evident in the happenstances of our lives, in the desires of our lives, in the outcomes of our lives. See, the whole point of this book is God is sovereign. I will share with you just a reflection after the message last week from my own soul. See, I process it before and after. I look back over the course of my life, and there were two very... I've been 25 years of ministry, and things have gone, you know, a bit challenges in churches, but nothing like this. I'm called into a church, actually, to be a temporary pastor for a while, because they booted a guy out. Not rightfully, but they did, but they brought me in. Then they decided they wanted me to stay. The ministry we had was bigger than it had ever been before. We had 26 conferences. I was pastoring full time, teaching full time, and I had this ministry. And we're incorporating Canada in the U.S. We had an employee in Canada full time, and we did conferences. We had 26 conferences across from Washington to Michigan and from British Columbia to Nova Scotia. 26 conferences in a period of 3 months that we were sponsoring. We bring in major Bible teachers to do them. Had a secretary that worked just for the ministry in the church office. We published 2 publications. The thing was really moving. My wife says the other day, first time she's ever said it, she says, "We were afraid for you that it was too much." And God must have realized it was too much too. There was a millionaire who ran the church. He'd run the church for years by his money. And he began to see the church growing as it hadn't grown in ages. The membership class we had at that time was over 40 people joining this church. And in a Baptist church, when 40 people join and you got votes, it's sort of scary to these people who've controlled for years. So therefore, he said, the millionaire says, "I'm leaving the church." And the deacons realized it's easier to get a new pastor than a new millionaire. So therefore, I was shown the door. Went to a Chinese church. They called me. I went there, helped them get into a brand new building. In fact, I told them the property next door was being sold by a Vietnam vet who was into drugs, and it was really a drug center, so he had to sell it. So I says, "You buy that and I'll build a second story on it." I'd never built a second story in a building, but I did there. And it's interesting, you do all of this stuff, it would never have happened otherwise. And the ministry is going well. But see, they decided when the building was finished to refinance. So they went to the finance. I had nothing to do with that. They went to the financial people, and the financial people says, you cut down your bank accounts. You have 20-some bank accounts, and that's not good for we people who are doing the financing. So they cut it down. But then when I do leadership, I was the pastor of the English congregation. There was a Cantonese and Mandarin one, and so I was the senior pastor because the English congregation basically made up of young guys, okay? They didn't want the older people, like in the Chinese culture, telling them what to do. So when they started this church, they made sure the Cantonese had two elders, Mandarin had two elders, and the English had five, so they could always outvote them. So I come in here, they're going to a single bank account, or at least no more than three or something, and I'm in charge, and we have elders meetings, and I'm letting everybody have equal say. Scared the daylights out of them. So, as much as God had blessed, in fact, my last weekend there was a weekend, Memorial Day weekend, all three congregations together, and the three of them together honored us in an amazing way. They said, never happened in this church before. But that was our last Sunday there because these young people, they were threatened by what would happen, their control of the money. That was all about money, is what it is. So we had to leave there. You know, though, my very next Sunday was at Locker Center First Baptist Church, and if it hadn't been for that, there would have been no Stephen and Leslie, there would have been no six grandkids here, there would have been no mother and father-in-law that we are blessed to be a part with. You know, all of that, I'm just telling you. I said to him the other day, as I reflect on this week, it was painful. Never bitter. I think they will have tested. Never bitter, but painful. But you know what? When I see where we are today, the pain, every bit of it was worth it for what God has done. So just to say to you, when you put all of this in perspective, you just realize that you see, and let me take you to Peter just for a moment. Peter does talks about submission. It's interesting because he talks about four ways. Submission to society, submission at work, submission to home, submission to the church. And then when he's through in chapter 5, and we sang the song dealing with that today, he says, therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God. What's the point? You know, the only way we're able to submit to each other is when we submit to Him. And if we don't submit to Him, we're not willing to submit to each other. It's as simple as that. See, when you understand that God is in charge, you can submit to what Naomi tells you to do. You can submit to what Boaz tells you to do because you've submitted to what God is planning and orchestrating. And this woman doesn't understand all the theology. She hasn't a clue. But she selflessly submits herself to what God is doing, and look what God does. Now, let me take you to here. Selfless satisfaction. The book ends with this, chapter 4, verse 12. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went into her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. I love this. God enabled her to conceive. And I will say to you, every conception is from God's hand. It is. Then Naomi took the child and laid him in her lap and became his nurse. And the neighbor women gave him a name saying, a son has been born to Naomi. Not to Ruth, to Naomi. So they named him Obed. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David. Do you know what she did at the end? It's her baby, but she selflessly passed it on to Naomi. It was her blessing. It was her grandson. It was the replacement for the husband, the two sons that she lost. And here God gives her this child. But you know what? Somebody came up after I was dealing with this passage a few weeks ago. And they very insightful, and they were right. You know what's interesting? When you look at the genealogy, it doesn't say Mahlon and Ruth had a child called Obed. It said Boaz and Ruth. They gave the child back to the family, and God gave the child back to them, if you will, as far as God's whole record of salvation history is concerned. You know, it's all back to here. Where you go, I will go. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. It's just beautiful to watch the selflessness of a woman who was not steeped in theology, but certainly gave herself at each step in responding to the trials God brought in a way that brought honor and glory to Him, in a way that created this most beautiful short story ever written.